Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now, for over 40 years, the Office of the Ombudsman has been dealing with our complaints about the bad behaviour of government departments and councils and state bodies. And the investigators in this office, what they do is they quietly compel, often through embarrassment, it has to be said, these bureaucrats into correcting or indeed reversing decisions. Ger Deering is the Ombudsman today. Good morning, Ger.
Good morning, Oliver.
You haven't been there for all the 40 years. No.
Doing just to clarify that.
You're exceptionally well dressed. Are you dressed like this all every time?
Of course.
Every day for the Ombudsman. Come here, you're from Laois Carlow?
Where's it? Born in Carlow and grew up in Laois. I spent a lot of my working life between the two counties.
Oh, did you? So do you identify as one or the other?
Depends on the day. I'd be very supportive of both counties.
Oh, how does that work? There must be one.
We don't get a lot of days in Croke Park for either, so it's not really a big problem.
No, but there are days out otherwise.
Ah, yeah,
the club scene will always make up for it in every county that doesn't get Croke Park and big days. Come here, are you a lifelong civil servant forever?
No, not at all. I've a very varied, mixed career.
Oh, yeah.
I worked for myself as a landscape contractor and had a flower
Did
shop.
You?
Indeed, one of my colleagues in my previous job when I was leaving very kindly wrote on my card that anybody who can be a colourblind florist can do anything.
You're colourblind and you worked with a florist?
Yes.
Does that affect the job of a florist?
It can do, but not hugely.
Okay. Yeah. If someone rings up and says, I want the
white... Ask somebody what colour is that?
That will do it. And Camille, that's a lovely outdoor job that you gave up to sit in offices for the rest of
your life. But that was in the 1980s and things were very, very difficult. And we started the family in the 80s and trying to make a living at that stage. We've had recession since, but that was the recession and there were very difficult times. So I saw a job in a local authority, applied for it as a rent collector. That was my first outing in terms of working in the public service. And it gave me a great insight, Oliver, because on a weekly basis you were going around to about 500 doors and you were hearing people's stories, genuine stories, and you knew the difficulties and the problems they had. And I think it was great grounding for me in terms of other jobs that I took on afterwards.
That job still exists, by the way, the rent collector in Dublin City Council. Someone told me that there is a door-to-door collection.
There's very little door-to-door. And that time, I remember a lady once sitting on the bottom step of her stairs, and when she paid the rent, she said, there, that's all the money gone. Because everybody used to call. The insurance man, the coal man, the rent man, all men that time, all called looking for
one
money.
One
after the other. And... yeah.
So that was a good grounding, wasn't it, for the job
was,
that you have
absolutely.
Now? Because people are... the Office of the Ombudsman, where is that located these days? Is it?
We're in Earlsford Terrace, just across from the National Concert Hall.
Oh, very nice.
Moved there just before COVID.
Are there tons of people working in there?
Well, there's a number of offices. So there's about 50 people dedicated to the Ombudsman, just about 56 people dedicated to the Ombudsman role. And then we have other roles as well, there are supporting roles and others. But hardworking people, as you can imagine, from the amount of work we get through with relatively modest number of staff.
Are they lawyers or accountants or what qualifications?
No, we have a really broad range, and really what you need to be an ombudsman investigator is somebody with an inquisitive mind, somebody who is fair and thinks fairly about situations. So we are very happy that we have lawyers and we have the legal input, but it's the day-to-day work is very much about looking at were people treated with dignity and respect.
Okay.
Is this a reasonable outcome? Because sometimes you'll find that the rules say one thing, but you need to be reasonable in your approach to actually applying them. And that's what we bring. We bring this helicopter approach. We're independent. We're impartial. We're not actually on the side of the complainant. Sometimes that's misunderstood, because if we lose our independence or our impartiality, we're no good to anybody. So we're taking this helicopter view of looking at this from the outside. Was this a reasonable approach? Was this a reasonable
So the type of person comes to you, they've already gone to a public body or department
with
their complaint.
Yeah, we expect them to go back. And I know you said earlier that we complain a lot, but actually really Irish people often aren't good at complaining. How many times have you been in the restaurant and we're all complaining, or people are complaining, and the server comes over and asks, is everything okay? And we all say, yeah
that level, yeah.
So people sometimes are...
Or we complain about something, but we don't complain to any authority about it. Like
to the person maybe who
road.
Can actually make a difference, you know.
Okay.
So it really is important, because complaints are actually, they're not a negative, they're a learning process, and they can... we have many, many examples where complaints have actually improved the service for others.
Yeah, I would say a lot of people wouldn't realise the differences that the Ombudsman has made in the last couple of years. It's 40 years
That's
since
right.
the work began, so we're talking 19...
84 actually started, just over 40
okay,
years.
So yeah, of complete work.
Michael Mills was the first ombudsman appointed in 1984.
One of the cases caught our eye, it's 1986, it's very early days in the operation, and it delivers for women essentially kind of trapped in marriages, aren't they? They couldn't divorce from them. Tell us about dependent domicile, because it's a...
Dependent domicile was an extraordinary thing. And in fact, over the 40 years, I see the work of our office, it's kind of an expose of the country and how it developed. But a dependent domicile meant that a woman was domiciled where her husband... Domicile means where you live, yeah, where you're grounded. And it has... It mightn't sound like much, but it has huge implications for tax, for social welfare.
Of course, yeah. Your primary residence.
Correct.
Your address, yeah.
And so a woman was considered to be domiciled where her husband lived. So
not where she lived. Wherever he went.
It was irrelevant where she lived or where she was from. Wherever he lived, she was considered by the state to be domiciled. And in fact, it went further, by the way. Children were domiciled, had different domicile depending on whether their parents were married. It was quite an extraordinary common law that we inherited from hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. So it was one of the first things that the Ombudsman called. In fact, Michael Mills called it out in 1984. And I'm glad to say it changed in 1986. But, you know, even if we look at the language of the time, I'm old enough to remember that when a death notice appeared in the paper and the husband had predeceased the wife, she was the relict of the late. You know, this kind of language. I met it in my previous life in the Financial Services Ombudsman, where, you know, historically women had very little say in financial terms. Indeed, I remember Nell McCafferty telling a great story about when she came to work in the Irish Times in Dublin. She wanted to buy a television on hire purchase, which was very common that time.
It was, yeah.
The gentleman in the shop said, "You have to have a man as a guarantor for you."
Unbelievable.
Yes,
yeah.
Unbelievable. So she walked out on the street, she tapped a gentleman on the shoulder, he very kindly came in, and she had no idea who he was, but he signed as a guarantor. That qualified.
Good,
on
practical Nell McCafferty
absolutely
solution.
Absolutely, very practical solution. The man in the shop was happy because a man had gone as guarantor, and she said to him, "By the way, what do you work at?" to the man going out. He said, "Oh, unfortunately, I'm on the dole."
So the poor man is unemployed.
Yeah,
and they didn't trust the woman
who has
working
a
job.
Salary.
Yeah. So
I'm glad to say that times have changed and that our office has been part of that change.
What was the issue? How did women suffer from that issue if their husband disappeared?
In terms of dealing with the state, they had a grave difficulty because let's say you wanted to apply for a benefit, you weren't considered to be living in the state because if he was living in England, then you're domiciled.
So
if
he up and left the family.
Correct, yes.
I need welfare now, whatever. The state said, "No, well, you live in England now."
Exactly. It was bizarre. So there was an actual act passed, a legislation brought in 1986. As a result of the Ombudsman bringing attention to it, and it was rectified.
It is a kind of a constant case of embarrassing the bureaucrats, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in a position where I've had both the power to direct, which is a legally binding decision, and also currently I make recommendations. There are benefits to both. The problem with the legally binding decisions is you can often end up spending a lot of time in court and they're appealed to the High Court and you spend your time with legal arguments.
Right.
We spend our time with what I would call moral arguments and reasonable arguments and looking at what's fair and just in the circumstances.
In the early days, you looked at the Ombudsman Office had jurisdiction, I suppose, over on post. Not anymore. And this is the case of a wedding dress.
That's right, yes.
That someone posted.
About 10 days out from the wedding, a lady posted her wedding dress and the bridesmaids' dresses to the next county to have them altered.
Yeah.
Now, on one level, this might seem light, but my own daughter got married last March, so I know how important these things are.
Yeah.
Yes. So with 2 days to go, the dress still couldn't be found. It got lost in the post. It had gone into the international post and eventually on the day before the wedding, it was actually found. So you can imagine the relief. But even move on to after the wedding, at the time, it was the Department of Post and Telegraphs, and that's why they came under our jurisdiction, but they refused to give any compensation. This lady had spent overnights in Dublin. She had a lot of costs and everything to try and retrieve the dress. So eventually they gave her £80 at the time, which was probably a reasonable amount of money at the time to cover her costs for trying to find the wedding dress.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the more unusual cases we dealt with.
It's kind of like just asking the public body to have a bit of decency, isn't it?
Exactly.
And is that what your job is often day to day?
Absolutely. Just put yourself in the place of the person, the complainant, and ask yourself, you know, are you being fair to them and are you being reasonable to them?
Into the 90s now, it's kind of, it would be amazing for people to learn that there was no maternity leave for mothers who adopt.
That's
children.
Right. That's right. They weren't treated the same as mothers that had children naturally. So again, the Ombudsman drew attention to this and I'm glad to say that adoptive leave was brought in at the time and that inequality was regularised.
A huge change.
Absolutely. A very significant change for people.
It seems remarkable. So they would have complained initially, whoever brought that case, yeah, to the department, not rectified, and then they came to the Ombudsman.
The Ombudsman, yes. And there's two things we do. One is we deal with individual complaints, but we also issue investigative reports where we look at an issue systemically. And we've done a number of those, and they have been very significant impact.
We know there's lots of scandals involving hospitals and missed diagnoses and so on. This is a case of a botched hospital appointment that leads to a delayed diagnosis involving an ancient printer. This sounds like something from the early days of the Ombudsman, but...
But it's not. It's very recent. It's in the last few years. And it was actually St Vincent's Hospital. A lady had had a... And this is a good example of where we really couldn't do much for the lady concerned at this stage, but yeah, she did not want this to happen to anybody else. Right. And that's why she came to our office. So basically what happened, I didn't know, if you've had a transplant, you were more susceptible to cancer. You're more risk. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, a referral was made to another part of the hospital by the consultant. The letter was dictated, it was typed, it was signed. It got lost. It didn't go to where it should have gone. She came back for an appointment after a number of months. It was discovered that this hadn't happened. The other appointment hadn't happened.
This printed letter just went missing in the same hospital it was going
to. Yes. And yet another letter was issued and it didn't reach there. When we investigated, we said, you need a new system. And the first offer was, well, we get a new printer and a new system distribution. And we said, we don't think that's the way to go. In the age we live in, an electronic system. And I'm pleased to say that that system and that referral system is now in place. And I understand it's electronically transferred and checked every day. So that in the hope that this can't happen to somebody else.
What happened to the woman?
I don't know the outcome, but at least it was detected eventually.
Right.
But she did have cancer. She did have cancer.
It
was a delayed
treatment
diagnosis.
Treatment is delayed and so on. Just for something.
Yes.
And that was in 2023.
Correct.
When that solution, which is now in place for everyone else. There are extraordinary cases to do with, we'll talk about the health again, because the medical assessments, people will know getting medical treatment outside the state. What was the problem here and how did you fix it?
Yeah, we had a number of complaints in this area, Oliver, and it was quite extraordinary. It really was an over-bureaucratic approach. I want to say the schemes are very good. There's three schemes, I won't go into the detail, but there are three schemes that you can use if you can't get treatment in this country or if the treatment is delayed too long in this country. And you can get your treatment abroad and then have a refund.
So you have to pay for it?
You pay for it, yes.
Front, okay.
You pay for it up front.
And then you come home and you go to the HSE, is it?
Exactly. To get your refund. Now, the fact that people had to pay for this, these are people who wouldn't generally have money, because if they had, they probably would have private insurance and would be able to do it that way. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. One lady had a hip operation. She travelled with her sister. When it came to paying, her sister, she didn't have the money, so her sister paid.
That would be very typical. Yeah.
Very typical. But when they came back, they were told, no, you are supposed to pay, not your sister.
That little technicality, they just said no.
Absolutely. We also had a situation where, unfortunately, letters were signed by maybe a secretary to a doctor, and the position was that the doctor was actually supposed to sign. And finally, we came across a situation where people, for example, were travelling to Northern Ireland to have cataract operations done. Now, if you're travelling for a cataract operation, I'm sure it would not be safe to drive yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So some good Samaritan is going to drive you, a neighbour, a sibling, whoever. At that time, the HSE were looking for proof of travel. So you had to go back to the kind person who brought you and say, could you get a receipt for the diesel or whatever? Yeah. You already had proof because you had had the operation done.
Yeah.
You had paid the bill. Anyway, the very good news there was I engaged with Bernard Gloucester just after he came into the chief executive post of the HSE. He immediately said, I'm going to implement all of the 18 recommendations in that report. So two things happened. The people that had come to us who had complaints got their refunds, but they broadened that out to other people and examined other cases. But most importantly, I can honestly say that scheme is now operating in a patient-centred approach in a very positive way. So that's a real good example of where...
It is, but it's almost like, how is that even the case? That do we have civil servants going through little documents that they sound like bitter people who just don't have the decency like that you would expect a normal person to have,
look,
and go, look at using a technicality to try and get out of paying a bill,
given
the wastage that we see all the time.
Sure, but I have to say that the vast majority of civil servants, public servants we come across, want to do their job well and do it to the best of their ability. Now, sometimes what happens is people become over-bureaucratic. And sometimes, Oliver, it can be actually that people, and I'm not defending anybody, but it can sometimes be that people, you know, if they do something and they're pilloried, by an audit report, or by the public or by whatever for not adhering to the rules.
Yeah.
But, you know, audits and things like that take account of people's circumstances, and people need to, you know, look at something in the broader picture and ensure that they're not just applying the letter of the law, but the spirit of it as well.
You're very measured when it comes to these things. There was a maddening case. A county council, this was, I think, Dunleary Rathdown, it says in the book, refused to pay for works to adapt a house for a man with disabilities. And this man was dying.
Yeah, that was quite sad. Now, again, this comes back to actually a rules-based situation. To qualify for these grants, you have to, the contractor who does the work has to produce a tax clearance cert. At that time, there was no way of knowing whether the contractor had a tax clearance cert. These people got the work done in good faith with the builder, and then there was no tax clearance cert available. Eventually...
And the man would have paid the builder himself.
The man would have paid the builder himself and would have had to reclaim
the
back.
Yeah.
Eventually, common sense did prevail, and the minister used... But you'll see from the book that the local authority had to go to the Minister for Housing at the time, who had to go to the Minister for Finance.
Unbelievable.
For €2,000. Again, you know, we need discretion. We need people to be able to make these decisions. There's another very sad case. It's in the book as well. And this is, in my view, even worse, in the sense that a county manager who would be the CEO now of a local authority had discretion in the payment of these grants, and he or she had decided that somebody over 70, it shouldn't be given to somebody over 70 because it should be reserved for younger people.
Yeah.
That was an extraordinary...
It's mad.
We came across this in terms of transport for people with disabilities as well, where there was a cut-off point of 65.
Made no sense.
Is the suggestion that people over 65 shouldn't be out?
Yeah.
You know, these are antiquated things that we're still trying to deal with.
That's not dealt with.
That's not dealt with yet. That scheme, that transport for people with disabilities, that goes back as far as Emily O'Reilly's time as Ombudsman. She did an investigation. Mm-hmm. She said it was wrong and discriminatory that the cut-off point was 65. A year or two later, the government, on an interim basis, they decided to close that scheme to new entrants. There was another investigation into another scheme. They did exactly the same. And here we are 13, 14 years later, and those schemes. Now, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And one of the important things about our office, Oliver, is it's not just the fad of a particular ombudsman. Each of us takes up the baton from the previous ombudsman. So
yeah.
Peter Tindall took that on from Emily O'Reilly, and I'm still pursuing it.
She's the third one.
I'm the third one to pursue it, but I'm convinced we will.
Because you don't have the legal powers to compel any of this.
That's correct. But we have been bringing this to the attention. And when I called it out 2 years ago in my annual report, in stark terms, on that day, the Taoiseach of the day gave a commitment to actually do something. Mm. Another body was brought together to look at all of this. But I'm pleased to say now, we now have a commitment from the Taoiseach's department that the Department of Transport are actually going to put in place a new scheme. That mightn't sound significant,
but
up to now there was no department even responsible for it.
For a person who's disabled and they have, what have they access to up to the age of 65 and what do they lose the next day?
What they had that time, now they don't have it at all now. Only the people who are in the scheme have it now.
Yeah.
It was actually, that particular scheme gave a small amount of money to people who could use taxis or who could use other forms of transport.
Right. Yes, to get around.
Yes. Other schemes involved the tax relief on altering a car. But there's only one scheme left, by the way, and the scheme is wholly inadequate because it's a medically based scheme and you have to be so disabled to access it. It really is not acceptable. We should have a scheme, and in fact what the government is looking at now is a holistic scheme that's based on your mobility, not on your medical condition.
It's a desperate thing that we wouldn't have known much about. And there's so many failures in the area of disability this government and recent governments, hasn't there?
Well, look, Oliver, I say we wring our hands a lot about things that happened in the past and we think that they wouldn't happen today, but disability is an area that is not getting the attention it should. Another area that we've done work on is young people under 65 in nursing homes. People might be surprised to hear that there are about 1,300 people who have disabilities who are living in nursing homes. It is not a suitable location for them. There's nothing wrong with nursing homes for people who need nursing homes and who should be in them. But they're geared to people of an older age, sometimes with dementia, with particular issues. Now, I have to say, we drew attention to this. And the title of the investigation and the report we did was Wasted Lives. It's a little bit emotive, but it was coined by one of the people who actually was in one of these nursing homes, who said, I've wasted my life here.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Since then, I'm pleased to report, on the one hand, that the HSE did a very good body of work and started a programme which has seen 100 people move out. I visited some of those people in their homes. And the things they want to do, Oliver, are the things that everybody does. Go to bingo. Get a newspaper, have somebody in, a friend in for tea.
To live.
live normal lives. They're not asking for anything demanding. And the bad news about that scheme is that the good news is it got up and running and it got off the ground. And the bad news is last November we were informed that it's running out of funds. It has already more or less run out of funds. And what the HSE are trying to do is scrape funds from various different places. That is not acceptable. There should be a dedicated fund to this project. Mm. It's called the Under 65s Programme.
Sounds too much like an afterthought if they're just scraping it from here and there.
Unfortunately, yeah. But like, if the will was there to do these things, they can be done. And we will continue to pursue government to
see
if they are done.
You must feel sometimes inadequate when you can't compel these very kind of basic notions of fairness that you can't.
Yeah, well, look, enforce. It's very rare that we can't, and sometimes it takes longer than it should, but we get there and I see my own staff, the satisfaction that they get when they achieve something for the people that they have made complaints and that are working. So there's great satisfaction in success and there's determination in terms of pursuing the things that where we haven't yet got success.
Well, sometimes it's very maddening. And just to complete that story, we're talking about the council. The man who spent $2,000 doing up his house, he was terminally ill. He never lived to see the resolution.
Unfortunately, he didn't see the resolution. He had passed away in the meantime. And that shows the need for people to be to adopt their decision to the circumstances. You know, if somebody's terminally ill, you have to treat it differently. Yeah. Than
and the civil servant who would have made that decision was completely legally
correct. They were following the rules, in fairness to them. They would have been following the rules.
It's just the humanity is the question for us. Yeah.
Humanity is something that we like to trade in a big way because it's very important to our work.
Gerard, there's loads of questions coming in for the office. I'd like to ask about the turnaround time for getting back to complaints. Do you have a big backlog?
We don't. We get about 4,700 complaints a year and it's been increasing year on year. And I'm pleased to say that 80% of our complaints are resolved in 3 months.
All right.
Yeah, and about 90% within 9 months. And then there are ones that take much more detail because we try to resolve them as informally as we can. We use the phone a lot. I call it old-fashioned innovation. You know, so many people now don't communicate by phone. We do, and I think that's really important. And because when people come to us, part of the problem they've had has been the communication issue. So if they're not able to communicate with us by phone or whatever preferred way they have, so we get through them reasonably quickly.
There's a question here. I want to bring a complaint about an incident with Garda. Would the Garda know who brought the complaint? This is obviously another office.
This is the office of the Garda Ombudsman, or Fishru as it's called now, that they need to take that to.
Do people know in general if it's something that is under your remit that they will know who brought the complaint?
It depends on the situation, but generally speaking, people are happy for their name. And
because they've already complained.
They've already complained, and also it affects them. So if somebody's looking for a particular grant or a particular thing, it really isn't possible to...
Anonymous.
Yeah, but we are... if people have an issue and they want to bring it to our attention anonymously or otherwise, we're happy to deal with it.
Please ask Gerard Deering about pensions for women. So many of us have broken service because we take time off to mind our children as state childcare is practically non-existent. Men don't have as many breaks in work service for caring reasons. That's an important question.
It is an important question, but we have to look at, you say, the current policy first and see what you know, is the person getting what they're entitled to under the existing legislation. So that's something.
The unfairnesses in legislation, there's nothing you can do about it.
We can draw attention to it, but we couldn't direct the government to change a policy, let's put it that way. But we can certainly draw attention to it.
And sometimes a compelling emotional case can be the thing that embarrasses the bureaucrats, as we're talking about.
Yeah.
Do you fear a day, like we're seeing it in Britain, we're seeing it in places like Hungary in the European member states and, of course, in America, where governments have just decided I'm going to ignore court orders and ignore civil servants and so on. Given the weakness of the powers of the ombudsman, that must be a fear for you and your staff that one day we could actually reach that point.
Yeah, I mean, we can never be complacent. And I'm always pointing out to people that we're independent in our work and our decisions, but we're not an independent republic. And you're absolutely right. We are seeing worrying trends around the world. And indeed, in the early parts of our office, a Taoiseach at that particular time wasn't a big fan of the office. And the Michael Mills...
Charlie High.
Yes, indeed. Michael Mills records in his book, Hurler on the Ditch, that in his first couple of years, his staff was cut from 20 to 15 and then from 15 to 10. So, you know...
Wow. It's an easy way, isn't it?
It's an easy way. If you starve somebody of resources, and we're fortunate, we've not been in any way affected like that, but I wouldn't be complacent, and I think we're an important part of democracy, and that's why it's important that we get opportunities like this to let people know that we are there and that the office has an important role to play.
Of course, in those days, in Charlie Haughey's days, ministers were directly responsible for lots of things that were going on in the country. Now you've got hundreds of state agencies which they can kind of go, oh, that's nothing. nothing to do with me. That's that agency over there. This was Emily O'Reilly's concern nearly 20 years ago. Would you share that? That there's
yes,
she had 450 state agencies, says, not under her remit anymore.
Yeah, well, that's
grown, I'd imagine.
That is, no, in fact, a lot of agencies have come under the remit of the Ombudsman since then that weren't there. So we do have a very broad reach. Almost any agency or organisation that is publicly funded comes under our remit, and that even extends now to nursing homes, because even though they're private entities, the people in them are generally supported by the public purse.
Dave has called into us and said, can you ask Ger about the word old, I presume in state agency one. I believe old should be dropped from things like old age pensioner. We should be just called aged pensioners. Have you come across that one before? Is that
I haven't, but it's a very interesting point, yeah, and something we're happy to look at, because language is extremely important.
That language is still there, is it? Do we still call them old age pensioners or just pensioners?
I'm not sure at this stage.
There you go. I thought you knew everything. I presume you knew Michael Mills. Ken is telling us he was born in Ballinakale, County Laois.
Of course, yes, yes. Very happy to follow the Laois succession there.
One of the issues raised is a lack of data, inability to get records to bring a complaint. So I presume you need to come with lots of documentation, do you?
Not necessarily, because all we need is an understanding. And if people have whatever the documentation they have, if they give it to us, but we have the power. There's a suggestion we don't have powers. We actually do have powers. We have legal powers to get that information.
To get the documents.
We can get the file. And that's really important. And actually, I thought one of the very interesting complaints that's listed in the book was where the health board had refused a farmer a medical card. And he went back to know, can I see the calculations of why? Yeah. And they said no. So the Ombudsman's office engaged and they said, no, if we give them those, it'll only get into an interminable communication about the reasons, which, of course, it should be. He should have been able to argue the reasons. But that'll tell you how we've moved. That was pre-FOI and all of that. Yeah. You know, so, no, we can demand the records and we get the records. So we've the full file, so we know what the reasons are why somebody is refused or otherwise.
Is freedom of information a little bit hampered now by the GDPR that we have from
I think there's a lot of confusion around that, and I think GDPR sometimes is overused as a reason not to actually give information.
I'm sure you hear it all the time.
You hear it all the time, and you know, it's actually a fallback argument. When all else fails, use GDPR as an argument, and sometimes it's used where it shouldn't be used. It's very important. It's really important that people's personal data is protected, but of course it doesn't need to be protected from themselves.
Yes, okay. That's a good point. Yeah, good one. I'm sure you get some daft complaints and things that come in. How do you get frivolous complaints that waste your time, and you have to politely come back and say that's not an issue?
No, we avoid using that word, because do you know what? If somebody thinks it's important enough and they've been, you know, it's not to say that all of the complaints could be upheld by any manner of means, but if it is important enough to them, we need to consider it.
Someone's delighted to hear a Carlo / Laois man. Gerald, know the people from Grey Cullen.
I do know them very well.
Carlo, have divided loyalties there.
Oh, well, I'll have to.
That's from Walter, by the way.
Well, I know exactly what he's referring to there, because there's the parish of Grey Cullen Collection. Is on the edge of Carlow, and my son is very involved in Collession GAA.
Right.
So there are a bit of rivalries there between Grey Cullen and Collession.
Does Collession fall in the Laois?
So does Grey Cullen. You better be.
So we don't know. So where do they play? Where do they land in inter-county level?
But they're both playing in Laois, but they both have their own club, even though they're the same parish. It's I wouldn't call it a divided parish, but it's a.
This
a
is like the Moneygall problem we learned yesterday in Offaly, but the pitch is in Tipperary.
Yeah, there are divided allegiances in that part of the world.
By the way, if we ever wanted to complain about you, the Ombudsman, then who do we complain to?
We have our own complaints mechanism where people can come to us. But in terms of, if you think the original issue, we're kind of the last stop on that. But if people are unhappy with our own service, obviously we have a complaints process that they can come through and we see how have we.
I was looking up the salary of the Ombudsman. I can't find it online at all. Are we not entitled to know?
Yes, it's the equivalent to a Secretary General Grade 3. And I'm sorry, I can't give you the exact figure, but anybody can.
There's a range.
There are three types of Secretary General, Grade 1, Grade 2, Grade 3. So it's at the Secretary General, Grade 3. I don't know the exact amount at the moment. I know I should. I know the net, which is slightly different than the gross. Okay, considerably different.
Yeah, you could tell us that if you want. But no, are you still doing flowers? Are you still landscaping away?
Well, only my own garden. Only my own garden. It's my release, my own garden.
There are people agreeing with you, think, because the comment here says people over 65, of course, have all the same desires and rights to be part of the wider community. Why are nursing homes not appropriate for under 65s, but they're okay for us older people?
Well, there's a very. I would like to make that really clear that if you're 20 years of age, I think in fairness, you have different needs than somebody who are 70 years of age. So what I'm saying is not a reflection on nursing homes, and it's not a reflection on the care that they give to the people who should be in there, not should rather, but who want or who have to be in there.
Yeah.
But the point is, a young person of 20 years of age, for example, one of the people we had spoken to in the investigation went to work. They were working, but they had no home other than the nursing home. So they went to work in the day and they came back in the evening to a nursing home. Sometimes they're restricted. They can't go back out to the cinema. They can't go back out to, as I mentioned, bingo. They can't go on holidays, many of them.
I suppose the flip side is that, of course, it's predominantly the age, isn't it? And an older person wouldn't want to be living with loads of young people.
Most likely, like yes.
It's a free book. It's going to be available to download on ombudsman.ie from about 2 weeks' time.
Right.
You're releasing it like Taylor Swift's albums. It launched late at night. But thanks so much, Ger Deering, for coming into us and answering our questions. And people can get in touch with the Ombudsman. Ombudsman.ie is all the details.
Thanks very much, Oliver.
Some people texting in saying that Ger Deering, our guest, sounded like is he a relation of John Creedon? Because he thought it was John Creedon for the first 5 minutes, and someone else thought Christy Moore is the Ombudsman. I'll sort out your complaints. I suppose, yeah, I can hear that. That's the whole Midlands thing. Deering for president, says Kieran in Booterstown. Steady on. I mean, like, well, I suppose, why not? Everybody runs now, but he is the Ombudsman and has to be held to account as well, just like all the other civil servants, which is what he's doing.